You're listening to the Webcomic Beacon Newscast at newscast.webcomicbeacon.com.
It's Sunday, July 1st, 2012, only a few days away from the American Revolution celebration. And this is episode 74 of the Webcomic Beacon Newscast. Joining us today, from BladeBunny.com, Eric Kimball.
Greetings and salutations, Internet.
From EvilSpaceCat.com, Marie Terry.
Happy Canada Day!
Our news editor, Jason Strasberg.
Hi there.
And of course, I'm Thomas Revor from 910 Comics. That's 910CMX.com, and let's look at the news. Our top story today, which may come at no surprise to people, is the movie that has just come out, can't call it popular just yet, Ted, from Family Guy creator Seth MacFarlane, may have been stolen. Well, maybe steal is a harsh word. Creatively appropriated. Over at dailycartoonist.com, there's an article from Alan Gardner stating that Tall Tale radio podcaster Tom Racine has noticed several similarities between scenes in the trailer, not the movie yet, but the trailer, for Seth MacFarlane's new movie Ted, and the webcomic Imagine This from Lucas Turnblom. Over on the page, he shows a side-by-side comparison of some of the images from the trailer with some of the scenes from Imagine This. And there are a lot of similarities. Now, of course, the question boils down to, of course, did MacFarlane acquire, borrow, steal, whatever word you want to use, some of the concepts from the webcomic? Well, Rob Tourneau, asked Lucas, who says he's not going to press the issue. And it says, many cartoonists, myself included, hope that their strips might someday be developed into a movie or a TV show. I guess Ted proves I was right to believe that my strip had cinematic potential. There is no evidence that MacFarlane was influenced by Imagine This, and the cartoon world, and Hollywood for that matter, is replete with stories about stolen jokes, reworked gags, and outright theft of ideas, all of which are extremely difficult to prove. Turnblom himself isn't pressing the issue or accusing MacFarlane of stealing his work. Now, there have been other accusations against MacFarlane of stealing ideas before, so it may come as no surprise that this is just one more. What his motivation is behind it is open for speculation. And now, let's go over to something a little more happier. Let's take a look at the buzz in the news with Marie. Marie?
Thank you. We got two stories in the buzz today. One, and our first one comes to us from io9.com and is basically talking about sites that if you are reading a lot of webcomics, make reading webcomics easier, but also finding webcomics easier. It is often difficult to follow webcomics, especially when they update sporadically, stop updating, or there's just so many of them that you follow. And they talk about a number of sites that are trying to help make things easier. Now, some of them probably are no-brainers, such as Google Reader for RSS feeds. But there's a few that are kind of new that it talks about as well, including Just the First Frame, which is a site that takes just the first frame of various webcomics. And if you like the first frame that you see or you like the image that you see, you can click through and read the whole strip. Another one includes Comic Rocket, which is one that that is a kind of a paginator one where you can go in and it keeps your place as you read a webcomic. So you just make an account, pick a comic and start reading. And then even if you close your browser window or your tab, it will hold your place in the archive so that you can go back and resume reading it at any given time. Archive Binge sounds like a really interesting one. I didn't get a chance to actually check it out myself, but it is essentially a specialized RSS feeder from what I get. And it's really good for going through archive comics with really, really big archives. And it allows you to basically set up a comic that you would like to read and select the frequency with like you would like to read it. And it will basically set that up for you so that you can read the archive in a manner that you actually want to read the archive. Like if you don't want to read it all at once, and it will just feed it to you. If you want to keep up with the webcomics on Twitter, there's Webcomic Tweets, which helps consolidate over 500 webcomic artists into one basically large page that you can see the most popular tweets of the day, pictures, discussions. And it could be a good way to discover new comics because often other webcomic artists will plug other webcomic artists. So you can kind of see what people are looking at. There's also Oh No Robot. Sometimes you want to find a specific comic, but you just don't remember where the archive lives. But it helps you. It's basically a webcomic search engine that sifts through nearly 200 different webcomic titles to find a particular one. So there is also a random comics browser, so you can just discover webcomics while you're surfing it. So you can go ahead and check that link out and maybe find a way to discover and manage your webcomics a little better. Our second story is coming to us from comicsalliance.com, and it is a story about basically gay pride gay pride comic characters, not necessarily web comic characters, but comic characters. And it includes 50 comics and characters that resonate with LGBT readers. The article basically says that it's not really a surprise. There are people who are geeky and who are also queer, who are looking for good role models and good characterizations of characters they can identify with. So it goes through 50 different pairings, or not pairings, but 50 different characters, and also includes like artists and such that have been identified as interesting, good characters for the LGBT community that aren't very notable, at least. Some of them include some very more mainstream characters that you would probably be more familiar with, like Richter and Shatterstar, Dazzler, if you remember that character, Lulu Moppet, and some you may not know, such as appearing from it in Japanese manga, Wandering Sun, to school-age kids from that one. I don't know if they mention their name off the top of the thing, but they mention the work. They mention various full works instead of necessarily specific characters, but the characters within them. There's a lot of characters here. So if you're interested, check it out on the website, on the link in the show notes. And that's it for the buzz. Back to you, Tom.
Thank you, Marie. And now we've got a little bit of an update for a story that we had last week. And for this, I'm going to hand it over to Eric and let him take it away. Eric?
Yeah, story update, or also termed Why Won't This Man Go Away? We have a number of stories about the Carrion Oatmeal Inman situation. The first one, a rather pleasant one, comes to us from the Washington Post, talking about Inman's thoughts on how he's going to set up his quote-unquote money shot. This is, as you recall, Inman promised that he would take a picture of all the money raised, along with the picture of Funny Junk's mother seducing a bear, and send it to the Funny Junk. And he talks about how he's actually going to do that. It's a sort of fun, light article from the Washington Post. Then going to not so light. Carrion has gone on to sue more people. An individual who set up a website called Charles Carrion, which states on the top of the site that it is a satirical website, has received a cease and desist letter from Charles Carrion. Now, the interesting part about this is that he registered this site privately and paid for registrars.com's private registration, which means that he should not have had his information revealed to Carrion. Registrar.com, however, as soon as Carrion came in threatening to sue them, immediately surrendered the information with no analysis of whether it was a valid claim or not. Under Registrar.com's agreement, it states that any accusation that the site is impinging on any trademark or other such things will allow Registrar.com to turn over information. And it appears that Registrar.com crumbled in a second as soon as Carrion asks. So we now know that Registrar.com's private registration means they will not reveal it to anyone unless someone asks. Interesting cause of private. So Carrion is suing more people. And as we go, Carrion has continued to sue more people because he is now also suing the Attorney General of California, presumably because he is not issuing out the subpoenas that Carrion wants to find everyone who he feels has wronged him. We don't have the details of what Carrion wants, but the Attorney General has been added to his suit in ever expanding set of suits. And yet it gets worse. Carrion has also filed an injunction to stop all money from collected to being donated to the charities. Now, as you remember, the basis of Carrion's suit is that Inman might be engaged in charity fraud. If Inman turned over all the money, he has no case, so Carrion has filed an injunction to try to stop Inman from giving the money over to the charities listed. He claims that if Inman turned over the money to the charities, Inman would receive a tax benefit from turning over the charities. This doesn't seem to line up with tax laws, but this is his claim, and he wants to stop Inman from doing this. He also goes on in his statements to say that he cannot attend court in San Diego in September because the $1,000 price tag to travel from Tucson, Arizona to San Francisco is just too much for him. It's too much of a burden. This is rather strange that anyone can find a flight from Tucson to San Diego for about $250. So Carrion apparently doesn't know how to use orbits as well as a number of other things. The last thing he does say in his filing is he is willing to drop all charges if Inman will disclaim all interest. And that is a legal term meaning that Inman says, I agree not to profit in any way, shape, or form from this. This has been rejected by Inman and his lawyers at this point. So it does look like this is going to court. And back to you, Tom. That's our Carrion update.
Well, I mean, I've definitely lost all interest in this a long time ago. But let's go ahead and take our first break. We'll get back with some more news, some real news, right after this.
The Geek Life Podcast is, get this, a discussion of all things geek. Technology, movies, television, books, comics, games, nothing is off limits.
Renew!
Sigh.
Renew!
What's this red blinking light?
I had that removed twice. Did you know that the MPAA film rating system began on November 1st?
No wonder we get all moody in the winter.
I know. You know, I wasn't going to say that.
Would you like some syrup?
Join Mike, Paul, Richard, and Melissa at The Geek Life Podcast at thegeeklife.tv.
Welcome back to episode 74 of the Webcomic Beacon Newscast. And let's go ahead and take a look at the business news. And for that, we're going to head back over to Eric. Eric, what's happening in business today?
Thank you, Tom. We have a couple of short business articles. Our first article comes to us from Robot 6, talks about a comparison of the American Library Association's convention versus a standard Comic-Con. You have a number of comic producers talking about the difference between the cons, the different vibes between the cons, and how they feel. It's sort of an interesting thing to watch if you're thinking of going to cons, just taking a look at other options to selling your books. Next, coming to us from Comic Book Resources, we have a short story that Penny Arcade will partner with Cryptozotic for an all-new comic. This is a comic that the Penny Arcade team has been testing on their site, and they're now going to take this as a completely new webcomic. It's called The Lookouts, and this is something they've been working on for a little while now. Also, speaking of comics being picked up, we have the webcomic The Plume being picked up by Deviled Stew Comics. This coming to us from Graphic Policy. The webcomic, highly popular webcomic Plume, will now be released out of Deviled Stew as a monthly. That takes us through our business section, and back to you, Tom.
And now that we've learned a little bit about business, let's learn a little bit about learning itself over in our education division with Jason. Jason?
Thanks, Tom. I didn't realize we were a division now, but that's cool. Two stories this week in education. First, coming up from Escapist Magazine, we have a video from Jimquisition, who actually, his series usually gets pretty much down into the nitty-gritty of the bonuses and things that are included in video games. But this time, he is going in and trying to reason out murder versus rape in video games and, by extension, popular media. What we have is, he's asking the question, and that which has been asked before, is if murder is, you know, it's one of the most heinous crimes, it carries one of the heaviest punishments. If it's so widely accepted in video games, then why aren't we hypocrites for not including rape? Jimquisition comes in on this, and he gives a lot of really good points of why this isn't true. I think it's really framed out in one of the best quotes, is people don't go through their lives worrying about having flashbacks about being murdered when they play a video game. The thing is that murder can be spun, murder can be justified, and murder can also be a victimless crime, which you don't have those things with rape. So it's a good 8 minutes, but it's something you should check out over at The Escapist. Our next story comes from MTV Geek, which Sean Kleefeld is talking about integrating social media into web comics. He gives a really good example from My Cardboard Life by Filippia Rice. And what she had done is she had taken her comic and taken two of her characters and made each of them from the comic as a jumping off point going into different social media, either going into, say, a DeviantArt account or going into an Instagram account, taking those characters, and you would follow them around and seeing what they're doing. You couldn't follow the story without doing it. It's a really awesome use. And Kleefeld also goes into some other uses of ways to think about bringing a better audience into your comic using social media and just using it as a tool to expand what you're doing with your piece. And that really is the end of our education section. So back to you, Tom.
Thank you, Jason. And now let's go ahead and take a look over in our tech division. We've got divisions now because we're multiplying so fast. And to start off our tech, we're going to take a look over at an alternative to CAPTCHA. For those who don't know, CAPTCHA is a little bit of scrambled text with the lines going through it or the multicolored backgrounds make it difficult to read so that you can't have a bot go through and automatically log in and get past your security. There have been plenty of problems with CAPTCHA. Well, now there is an alternative to it. Over at areyouahuman.com, they offer up an alternative called Playthrough. So rather than having to type in text, which is extremely difficult to read, it gives you a little game that you have to play. The example that it has shown for me is one where you have to put drinks in a cooler, where it gives you four options, and two of them are actually drinks. So if you don't play the game or if you fail, you're not human. That would explain the whole thing with Charles Carrion, but that's a different story, which we've already covered. Next up, we're going to take a look over at Comic Easel, which is one of the many WordPress plugins for people who wish to host webcomics. They're up to version 1.8 with a few updates. You can find this over at comiceasel.com. And in fact, the creator of Comic Easel, Philip Hofer, a.k.a. Frumpf, is going to have an interview today over at the main show at the Webcomic Beacon with Fess. So make sure to turn into that. You can find that, of course, over at webcastbeacon.com. And to listen into that program, find out what's going on. Third story is, surprise, surprise, all the tablets that are out there may not be the same size. I take this with a little bit of humorous bent, but it is a good article talking about some of the differences in the way that the layouts are done for the different types of tablets. I mean, the resolution on a Retina screen iPad is going to be different than the iPhone. It's going to be different than an Android tablet. It's going to be different than a Windows phone. And how you can work with that is something that people in the webcomics industry need to look at. One size does not indeed fit all, as their article says. And finally, from our friends over at GigaOM, careful Twitter, remember what happened to MySpace and Dig. Twitter has sent some shockwaves through the technology community with a blog post on Friday that talks about its plans for the future and suggests that those plans may not necessarily include third-party providers, third-party services, and applications. They're spinning it as a move designated to standardize the experience for Twitter, but it also shuts down a lot of the added features which Twitter has had through the third parties. Again, you can find that story over at our friends at Gigaom, that's GIGAOM.com. And now, let's go ahead and take a look at some of our tidbits in the news with Marie. Marie?
Thank you, Tom. All right, we've got two stories in tidbits today. The first one, science, it's a girl's thing, is a video that was actually released as a part of a campaign in the UK to try to encourage girls to go into science. Both of the videos that are in question are on YouTube, and you can view them. And one is essentially a rebuttal from a female astronomist who is talking about how this video is not what girls should be seeing to try to get, you know, the people who are into science. I've watched the video, and it basically features a sort of blending of fashion imagery and science imagery with a sort of very stereotypical look at male and females in terms of their likes, dislike, and what they, you know, the three women presented are young, attractive, almost supermodel-esque in their presentation. And it really is kind of very stereotypical, and she calls it out on that. So if you want to watch it, both the original video and the rebuttal, apparently this exploded all over Twitter, but you can check it out and make your own decision on whether or not this is the way to recruit young girls into sciences. Our second story comes to us from blaster.com, and basically it is saying that censored internet sites may soon show a sly Ray Bradbury tribute. Ray Bradbury, of course, wrote Fahrenheit 551, and what they want to do is that any website that is being blocked for legal reasons would be given a status code of 551 in honor of this, of his famous novel. If you want to read the rest of the article and the codes in it, it is obviously in the show notes. And that's it for the tidbits. And back to you, Tom.
Okay, thank you, Marie. And actually, I think that's Fahrenheit 451.
Oh, 451. Oh, yeah, sorry.
551 is the temperature at which flame wars burn, not paper.
Ah, yes. Well, we know I can't get through a podcast without screwing something up.
But talking about flame wars that burn, let's go ahead and take a look at our oddities over with Eric.
What? oddities. We got two short little oddities today, not really webcomic related. The first one is a video called Everyday Bruce Banner, and really, I'm not going to say anything more about that. Go check out the video. It is amusing. The second one we have coming to us from, the Everyday Bruce Banner was brought to us by Robot6 and a couple other sites on the web. The second one we have is the 8 Gamer Alignments created by Blue Box Rebellion. And this is showing when you're playing role-playing games, you have two alignments. You have Dickhead versus Reasonable and Actor versus Gamer. And between those, you get the 8 possible alignments of any gamer you will ever play with. And it's sort of a fun little look at gamers themselves. And if you're familiar with D&D, it's based off of that. Those are our oddities this week. Back to you, Tom.
And let's go ahead and wrap up our news section of the program with some stuff from Jason. Jason, you've got something in our things that make you cry division.
Oh, thank you.
We already had Eric, so what else can make us cry?
Oh, just one story this week. Coming from the Beat, it's talking about DC's new ad campaign to feature their creators, who they actually term as makers. The reason that this is very hypocritical, which is just kind of sad, is the fact that DC's pushing this. The term makers is something that denotes possession, or that someone is actually taking ownership. If you know the big two, I mean, if you're going to play with their toys, they can take them away anytime. So you have these nice pictures of Scott Snyder and Geoff Jones. In a year, they may not be there. It's kind of a false pretense where they want you to meet the creators. They want you to take part and get all warm and fuzzy, but you know what? If they find a better artist in about 3 months, they're just going to knock them out. So yeah, it's a little sad. Of course, if you go over to Marvel, they also have the term architects for their house of ideas. Still the same kind of thing. So yeah, it's pretty sad. And that's it for things that make me cry.
And before we take our break, I just called this article up. I find it interesting because it's actually, they've got a comparison as to an ad campaign from Image Comics. Very similar, where they have a photo of the creators, the writers or the artists or the editors doing their work with a little bit of a quote on there. I mean, and God knows that DC would never do anything that Image has done in the 90s and rehash that.
Wildcats.
New 52.
What? Oh.
But we're going to go ahead and take our second break now. We'll be right back after this with our discussion portion of the program. So make sure to stay tuned for that.
This program is a part of the Webcast Beacon Network and is hosted on the Rampage Network. Follow us on Twitter for news links as we find them at WebcomicZ. Email us at webcomicbeaconnews@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 1-320-310-0922. Love the show? Please grab the iTunes or RSS feed. We're also on Stitcher.com with Stitcher Smart Radio, an on-demand service where you can stitch podcast and radio show feeds together for your own personal streaming service. The Webcast Beacon Network, covering and promoting creativity in the creative process since 2007. Webcomics, comic books, news, and web fiction at webcastbeacon.com. Now, back to our show.
Welcome back to episode 74 of the Webcomic Beacon Newscast. And joining us in our discussion today is, from BlakeBunny.com, Eric Gimble.
Greetings.
EvilSpaceCat.com's Murray Terry.
Hello.
Our news editor, Jason Strasberg.
Hi.
And our special guest today joining us are the people who run the popular DC area convention, Intervention, which you can find at interventioncon.com, Harknell and Onizumi.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey. Glad you could join us today. Now, Intervention's been going on for what? This is your third year for doing Intervention?
Yep. This is year three.
Yep, coming up this September.
For those who don't know, what exactly is Intervention? I mean, it doesn't exactly look like your standard comic book convention, does it?
No. What we tried to do with Intervention is, it has a large amount of webcomics at it because that's, of course, what we come out of. But it's really a cross-the-board internet-based convention. The name Intervention, in fact, is a combination of the words internet and convention, with a little bit of the edge about, you know, trying to prod people to actually get involved with putting their work online. But that's the ultimate goal of our event. It's to showcase the best in blogging, comics, video, music, regular standard writing, anything that you can do creatively that you then post on the internet as your main distribution of your work. Those are the type of people that we bring down to the event. So it ends up being a lot of a combination of a fan event, because, of course, you know, some of your favorite comics or musicians can be at the event. You go there and talk with them, you know, and get some insight into the fandom side, but you can also learn from them. That's the other key element. You go there and find out how did they do it. And they're all keen, all of our guests are keen on passing along all of their secrets, so to speak, and how they got involved. So we're sort of a convention with a conference and the best of both. And that's why we wanted to do the event to, you know, bring all of that together.
Now, you certainly have an all-star guest list from the webcomics world. I mean, I'm seeing people on there like our good friend T. Campbell. I'm seeing Pete Abrams on there. I'm seeing, some, of course, Jenny Breeden. I mean, what's a webcomic convention without her?
Exactly.
Who are some of the other people that they can look forward to?
Well, this year we have Danielle Corsetto. She is going to be new this year. We have Shannon Garrity. She's coming back this year. Some of the more exciting things outside of the webcomics side specifically are we're bringing in a lot more video stuff this year. There's a few people that are I can't really specifically talk about because they're signing up hopefully in the next week or so. But besides, you know, all of our huge list of webcomic guests. We're going to have a lot of new video stuff being either premiered or shortly right before their actual releases. We have the guys from Enlight Entertainment. They're coming back this year. They do the Ninjas Versus series. They started with the zombies. Then they did vampires. And then they're going to be doing, I think their last one is monsters. So they're going to be coming and doing, you know, a behind-the-scenes discussion and things of that nature. Many others are going to be coming in. So we're really happy about the video side, but we also have a lot of the comic side as well.
Now, how much are the tickets to Intervention?
Right now, up and through July 4th, which is a little bit of a change because it was originally going to be the end of June, they're going to be $35 for a full weekend rate. We're extending it to July 4th at midnight because many people were affected recently by all the power outages, and we've been told that it actually could extend all the way through July 4th. So we're being, helping out the people that may not have been able to hit our original date.
Yeah, we got a lot of text messages about that.
Like, after July 4th, it goes up to our $40 rate, which is still $5 off of the at-door rate, which is $45.
This is where I could make a joke about most of the people in Washington being in the dark, but I'll save that for later. But, I think the last question I've got for that is, why don't we have anybody from 910 over there? I mean, I would love to be a guest at Intervention, but nobody contacts me.
Wait a minute. You forgot. The centerpiece of their whole program is that Eric Kimball and Jason Strasberg from the newscast are going to be there. I mean, they're building a whole con.
Hey, you guys want to come on down? Come on down. We would love to have you.
That's the other thing that we should mention. Like, we're run by about between... Mostly it's just Harknell and I and a few other people before the event that actually set up the entire thing. And at the con, we have about 50 or so staff that come and help us run it. We only know our part of the internet, so I encourage people that want to contribute to send us a pitch, tell us who you are, what you do, and what you can bring to the event. Because we're not looking for, it's not a popularity contest, we're actively looking for new people to showcase, and our primary criteria is that you're excited about it and that you really understand that education is important, helping others is important, and possibly having Super Mario Brothers and Harry Potter belly dance at night is hilarious. And maybe insanity. Yeah, the programming gets a little bizarre at night because we believe in having awesome stuff. So send us a pitch. That's what I'm saying. Everybody is totally valid to hang out with us.
And one side note, in terms of the pitches, if you actually go to the main site at interventioncon.com, under the programming section, the programming page, there is a way to actually submit, hey, we want to, have this done at the event, or, I'm interested in being a part of the event. So you can easily just submit something as well if you're just,
Be afraid to follow up with us. As Eric knows, we get super, super busy. I'm always reachable on Twitter at Onizumi, spelled just like one Zumi. And you can always kick me there and be like, hey, Oni, I sent you something. What's the deal? And I'll be like, oh, crap, I've been meaning to reply to you. I will get to it now. So, yes, we're very reachable, too.
Terrific. And again, that's at interventioncon.com. And what's that Twitter account again?
My Twitter is at O-N-E-Z-U-M-I. And the Intervention Twitter itself is at InterventionCon. And that's just news and things like that. It's not my personal, possibly profane tweets.
Okay, everybody go ahead and head over there and take a look, and we all hope to see you over there at Intervention if you are interested in the webcomic or the web media world. But now let's go ahead and get into our discussion. We'll go ahead and open up. Marie, I'm going to hand it over to you for this particular topic, partially because you're the one who covered it in the newscast, but also because you're a girl.
Well,
science, it's a girl thing. Now,
we have at least one other girl here, too.
Yes.
I'm in the business of marketing. I work in a marketing department and I am a graphic designer and all that. And they're posed with the problem of basically trying to make science appeal to girls. And I'm wondering what kind of market research they did when they put this video together in terms of appealing to girls to do science. And why they chose fashion specifically as a thing to overlay to science, or if this is the only one. I mean, it's supposed to be an entire campaign. I don't know how it's supposed to play out. If this is like the first video of many, I don't know. But I've dealt with fashion students before, and science is probably the last thing on their minds. So I'm not entirely sure if they're really appealing to the demographic of women who would be interested in and passionate about science, because usually those girls are not the big fashionista. They're certainly not supermodels. Normally they don't look like that. They don't think like that. So I'm not entirely sure why, you know, like I listened to the other woman's video, and she did make some good points, and other stuff. It was very, she would be obviously being very PC about it. In terms of sort of saying, but she felt sort of similarly, it's like, kind of like, well, is this really the best way to appeal to get more women involved in science? Like, it just seems really superficial and hollow.
Superficial is exactly the word that I was going to use. I mean, when I looked at the video, coming at it from a guy's perspective, I mean, makeup, powder, lipstick, and that's what they're using to advertise science. I mean, I see better things for women in science when I turn on things like on TV, like TNT's Rizzoli and Isles, where you see a woman who's doing the autopsies, or CSI or other things, where it shows that you can be female and smart. This doesn't give you anything. I mean, this reminds me back of the Barbie doll that said, math is hard.
Yeah, exactly.
It really doesn't give anything.
It's appealing to a stereotype and not an actual human being. I think that's the core of it.
Yeah, and it also, I think it excludes, like, I mean, just going for myself, it's like, I never looked like that. I never dressed like that. I never had a huge interest in makeup and everything else. And I was big into biology when I was younger. And I might have actually gone a different career path if I could actually do math. But my creative brain rejects that. But still, I never would have, if I'd seen that when I was a young person and I was interested in biology, I would have been like, what, you gotta be a supermodel to do science? Are you kidding me? Like, this is bull. Like, I would have felt insulted and demeaned, intelligence insulted and demeaned by seeing that personally.
Now, let's be fair. I mean, because back in the day when I was in high school, I knew that a lot of the cheerleaders were interested in biology.
Yeah. I was interested in dissecting pigs, okay? I was interested in viruses and parasites in food. Like, I'm talking hardcore biology, not reproductive biology.
I mean,
But go ahead, Eric.
The problem here is, and this is a cultural problem, and I mean, in culture, we have a belief that there is one type of girl. There is the cheerleader. That's it. And all girls are either cheerleaders or they are failed at becoming cheerleaders. And that's it. There is only one archetype, where there are plenty of male archetypes. And one of the things I mean, I was into science myself, and, you know, I have degrees in math and psychology, because I saw these mad scientists and I'm like, I love Doc Brown from you know, Back to the Future. I saw that and I'm like, oh my God, you can have a career where you destroy the time space continuum. That's awesome. I want a piece of that, you know? And it was one of these things where you can't just say, well, girls want to be pretty, because it's sort of looking at women as one thing. You know, what do girls want? Well, they're people, you know? And so they want all different things.
I was going to say is like, well, you know, it's like, there's also that whole stereotype of like, well, I'm pretty and math is hard. So, you know, like I don't know if they're trying to equate being beautiful and smart. Like, it might be something that they're trying to do, but I think they totally went the wrong way about it.
The strangest thing about this is all the sociological studies that I've ever read about this area always point to, it's not really a case where girls and women are not interested, in fact, in science. It's almost always comes down to the sociological pressures and the actual environment of the scientific arena that pushes them out. It's a lot like IT. So the problem isn't the women not being interested. It's usually there's a hostile environment created by certain groups of men, usually, and also certain parts of the academic experience frown upon it, where they sort of like, well, what are you taking this class for? So it's not real. It's kind of almost the premise of it doesn't even seem to match what sociological studies have shown to be the problem. So it's almost like they're matching up something that doesn't even make sense in the first place.
Yeah, I disagree with the where it primarily is men or the educational system. Because I know that the again, the cheerleader set, the popular crowd can be extremely vicious towards people who don't fit in, female or male.
Yeah, but we and have male scientists.
This is trying to go through and merge them. I won't even say that is a situation of where they'd like it or they don't like it. But this video, I think, just completely fails at giving. I mean, it's not a, okay, you can be pretty and smart. No, it's a, if you want to be smart, you have to be pretty. And this is the only avenue for it. There really is nothing else showing anything else there. It almost looks like a stereotypical rock video from the 80s.
Yep. Remember, yeah, women, exactly. If you're not pretty, you're worthless to society. That's the lesson we have here.
Well, at least that's a lesson they're trying to teach you. And I'm not buying it! Because this is just kind of a personal anecdote. Is like, my sister, my sister is like a model. She modeled for Hawaiian Tropic and everything else. She's skinny and beautiful and tall. I am not. I'm the exact opposite. I'm built like a very squat brick house, and there's nothing I could do, no matter how much dieting I did, that I would not be kind of a short, broad girl. And I'm not, I don't have the same facial structure as my sister, and I don't have the same, I don't have the same hair as my sister. And for all intents and purposes, she's got several more beauty points in her attributes than I do. However, I'm an award-winning graphic designer, and she has two kids and lives in a trailer in my parents' backyard.
Oh.
So, let's not equate beauty and intelligence here and drive. Yeah. Because, I mean, if you're really, really passionate, and I do know some people, some females who are very, very passionate about their sciences, do not, you do not say, no, you have to be pretty to be smart and everything else. And they'll be like, no, I can, write rings around you any day. Thank you very much. So they'll, I think it has a lot more to do with, what you want and what you're willing to do to get what you want.
And to be fair, I know I've worked with plenty of women in the IT world and in the science world who are attractive, and some are downright gorgeous. So, I mean, it's not a either or, but this video certainly makes it seem like it.
Yeah, I know that's kind of ragging on my sister. She's not an unintelligent person, but her interests lie in different places, I should say. And I think that, to some degree, that her being very pretty and everybody kind of putting that pressure on her actually may have kind of limited some of her options, to be honest.
Well, let's go ahead and go into our next topic, and that is from over at geeknews.mtv.com from our friend Sean Clayfeld, with his article number 66, "We're Going on an Adventure." Let's go ahead and take a look a little bit at this, Eric.
Oh, me. Okay.
Yes, you.
I thought it was awesome. I mean, one of the things he did is he actually threaded his story through the social media and adjusted the character design as he took it to different media. So when he took the character onto DeviantArt, it was a cat girl. And then when he took it to a different areas, he adjusted it kind of cool. I think it was a very clever way of doing it. And people should really work on doing those things a little bit more. I think it's very useful. But I thought it was cool.
Now, Jason, I mean, you're the one who had the story up and covered it. Go ahead and give us your thoughts on it as well.
Well, I think that we can't devalue the fact of going into other venues to kind of broadcast ourselves. I mean, the fact is that it's always out there, and you can increase what you're doing. You just have to take advantage of it. And the reason I actually brought this article in, I was talking to Harknell and Oni. I see you guys not just on the website. I see you guys, pretty much getting around, mostly on Twitter and things like that. And I think that there's some value to what you're doing, especially with intervention. I mean, is there anything that you felt has worked or has not?
I think the best thing is that being out on social media, people start to learn about who you are. And especially with the first year of intervention, people that knew me knew that we were legit and that we, you know, will put everyone else before us. But people that did not know me did not know that. So I saw, you know, there's some people questioning, like, you know, what is this for? What's the deal? And quickly, the best way to get people to know who I am was to meet them. And just being out in the forefront and constantly engaging with people, people who did not know me before were able to get a sense of who I was and who Harknell was. And, you know, and it's translated really well insofar as the spirit of what we're doing. And, you know, people understand that if things go wrong, we never mean it that way and we always fix it. Very rarely things go wrong because we're obsessive. But, you know, they know our heart is always there in the place that it should be.
Well, one of the interesting things actually about this, and in many ways why we created intervention in and of itself, was this points out that many of the legacy or, you know, standard media approaches to things, which are very valuable in the way they are. I mean, obviously, no one's going to throw away reading a comic book, you know, as the experience of a comic book or watching a video or whatever, you know, DVD. But one of the more powerful things about the internet is the ability to bring multiple media types together seamlessly. And it's an entirely new way of dealing with things. And it's the promise of what you can do with the internet. So these kind of cool different ways of, you know, bringing what is normally just a comic that you're reading, you see as one, you know, block of an image, suddenly you can have it interact with various other types of media somewhat seamlessly. I mean, one of the bigger issues you can talk about with these kind of situations is, well, this works really well, probably, you know, on your computer, but if you're reading it on your iPhone, does going through all the different locations act as seamlessly, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, or
but that's a secondary issue.
Site goes down.
Yeah, that's a secondary issue. But like just the notion of playing with how the internet itself works is an incredibly cool thing. And it shows how that distribution medium is an entirely different notion and has its own actual, you know, parameters. And that's why intervention, you know, that's sort of why we created that, to showcase those sort of notions.
Yeah, this is awesome.
Well, let me go ahead and spin it off, because I mean, social media nowadays, I mean, it's the cool and hip thing. I mean, it's even made its way into the world of automotive commercials. Do you think that with it, and seriously, they've got one that has to do with that. But
let's hear them out.
Do you think that integrating the social media into your comics, whether it be you going off and promoting it on the social media or blogging about what you're doing every 15 seconds, or do you think that this stuff is now a requirement to help promote your product?
I don't think it's a requirement if you have a celebrity that you're friends with that can kind of tank you in and give you a lot of traffic. But if you're just one person and you don't have any connections, I think it's very important, but there are many ways to reach success. So, you know, I'm sure I haven't heard of them all yet.
I think, you know, one of the more, again, going back to how the internet itself is obviously a different entire concept, you know, one of the biggest things you see is that creators on the internet tend to, and this is, of course, there are some people who are very successful who have no social media presence, but they tend to be a lot more approachable. You tend to be able to follow them in different contexts, either their Facebook, their Twitter, blah, blah, blah. The notion of the creator being accessible is something that's absolutely brand new. And I think it can easily add a huge element to how much quicker you can become successful. I don't know if it's absolutely necessary yet, but it certainly is very helpful.
I wouldn't say it's necessary, because if somebody's a total flaming jerk, they should stay away from social media.
Yeah, that's
I'm not going to name any names or do anything, but I have
Charles, carry on.
If he wanted to create a webcomic, it would probably get an initial bump, because people would be like, what the heck is he going to do? But, you know, in the long run, most people wouldn't want to stick around. Yeah, you
I
know,
have seen people who were popular get on social media comic? And tank their stuff, and tank in a bad way.
That's a separate discussion about how to do it correctly, of course.
Yeah, but I'm saying, like, not everyone should do it.
Yeah.
But it's important, I think.
Yeah. We are professionals. Do not try this at home.
Well, you know, sadly, there are many people that advice could have been given to, but, you know, we hope that people are not – absolute flaming jerks. So,
yeah, we do have some good experience about absolute flaming jerks going through and tanking a lot of webcomics. Crosby. but let's go ahead and I do think that a lot of the cross-pollinization that we're getting from the social media is, for the most part, a good thing because it's allowing people who may have just a tangent connected to you, allowing people to see some of the stuff that you're coming up with.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, then, let's go ahead and go on to the next story. I debated about adding this one because the people who know me know my feeling about him. Seth MacFarlane's movie Ted, which opened up this Friday, seeing the, and I use the term similarities to imagine this, a webcomic. There's a whole article of it, both the one that we covered earlier and another one over at editorandpublisher.com. So this one actually has some chops about what's going on with it. This is one from Rob Tourneau, and it is talking severely about MacFarlane's, I don't want to say outright theft, but certainly some very strong resemblances to the webcomic. And we're seeing this more and more. I mean, we talked about it in the newscast to where there is it seems like anything that comes out, somebody's going to say, hey, I had that same idea. And I know that a lot of the professionals in Hollywood, in the writing and producing segments, go through and say, I cannot look at anything because I don't want someone coming back and suing me. But is this really a situation of just a very strong similarity, a complete coincidence, or is this a situation of where there's smoke, there's fire?
I think the thing is, Seth MacFarlane adapts culture, you know, and there's a point where you can say, well, look at Family Guy's pretty similar to Simpsons. You can't argue that, and I don't even think Seth MacFarlane's argued that. He probably saw the webcomic. He said, hey, that's a good idea for a movie, and decided to adapt it to a movie. I think there will be enough differences from the movie to the webcomic that you can have plausible deniability. I read the webcomic, and it's not the same as the movie. There are similarities. The characters are similar, but it's not the same thing.
Well, I mean, this isn't the first time that MacFarlane's been accused of something like this. There was, back when Family Guy first aired, there is striking similarities, to use Tourneau's phrase, between the character of Stewie and Jimmy Corrigan, the smartest kid on Earth, a character from Chris Ware's popular comic Acme Novelty Library, where Jimmy Corrigan, created back in 1991, is an infant with a football-shaped head who fears his mother and invents things to try to escape. I mean, yeah, even the physical look, the similarities of the look, is something that cannot be ignored.
Yeah.
One of the biggest issues, you know, when you go involved with anything, you know, there's obviously two issues going on with these kind of situations. There's, you know, the notion of what is original versus what is an adaption. And then there's, of course, the absolute of copyright and how much money and or, you know, that sort of situation happens with these things. You know, there you see a lot of it where people will say, you know, I had this idea, it originated with me. And then you go, that's the heroic, you know, arc, story arc. You know, like, I created this character who's this guy who gets this sword and he's gonna, you know, the one fated to save the kingdom and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, this other movie came out that has a guy with a sword. He's going to say, that's mine. And it's like, yeah, but that's also, you know, potentially going as far back as Beowulf and as far back as whatever. So there's always that notion that people, when they've created something, and I'm not saying specifics in this particular case, but there's a lot of times where people think that, you know, I originated this entire concept. You know, theoretically, you know, there's other things where people talk to a animated thing, you know, goes back as far as Harvey, you know, that I can even think off the top of my head, you know, the bunny rabbit thing, the movie where he's talking to, you know, this supposed
Jimmy Stewart,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and of course, you know, going further back and again, I'm not trying to say specifics like in the specifics of this case, but, you know, the notion that there is a animated and or inanimate object that the person who's, you know, got problems, talks with, and it's got an attitude is not necessarily an original idea. The real problem comes down to the specifics of implementation. And that's when, you know, somebody, obviously a lawyer or somebody else, is going to go through this whole mess and then go, how much of it does it look like it was actually taken? And then you have the copyright issues and all that. You know, personally, I tend to agree a little bit more with Mike Masnick over at TechDirt, where, you know, to some degree, you can always utilize situations, even if there's outright theft, to your advantage. You know, well, if the movie actually tanks and nobody liked it, then you should probably not try to compare yourself to the movie. On the other hand, if the movie is spectacular and it goes gazillionaires and there's 17 sequels, well, that points out that what you're doing, and by the way, there's probably no way, although that does happen, where the movie people are going to be able to shut him down from the comic side. Well, you know what? There's a market there. Maybe people would like his comic a lot more, and then suddenly he has a promotional opportunity. So there's elements that you can take from what might even be outright theft to actually get you to the next level right there. But anyway, there's all kinds of different things, you know, that may or may not happen with this. Yeah.
The whole situation with Ted, I mean, it could be something as innocuous as an intern who had been reading Imagine This, and he talked to somebody who talked to somebody else who talked to somebody else who talked to McFarlane, and it just kind of went from there to where there were it was a basic general idea of what was going on, but it still is derivative of it to – like I said, the football-shaped character, a football head-shaped character, who is taken outright. But
oh yeah, I mean, there's definitely, you know, depending on how you want to react to this, and of course everybody reacts differently. You know, there are definite issues that can come around in these kind of cases. I mean, from what I've seen, the creator of the comic is dismayed that this thing seems to be very similar, but it isn't in and of himself specifically trying to do anything legal about it, you know. But obviously, as I said, it depends on how you go with this.
Exactly. Now, we're short on time, but I did want to bring up one more story. Or actually, Jason, you wanted to bring this one up, and that was the video of Rape versus Murder. Now, we've got about 5 minutes to cover it in, so go for it.
I did? Oh, okay.
I wanted to bring it up.
Okay, Eric, you wanted to bring it up.
We both do, thank you.
We both do.
You both wanted to bring it up.
You want to be rape and I'll be murder? That would be okay? No.
Go ahead, Jason.
I've been talking about it okay, let's just start off. I mean, have you ever come across a point in a story, a comic book, any kind of media, where that is actually, where rape has been a justified plot point? I mean, when has it ever helped anybody?
Yeah.
Well, if you say a justified plot point, I mean, that's a rather broad term, because I know from my own writing, I have used the rape of a character as a just like the murder of Bruce Wayne's parents, or
it's an inciting incident.
Exactly. It is a motivation for another character. So, but I mean, the act itself.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to talk about the reality of it, I mean, it doesn't help anybody. Well, neither one really helps anybody on the positive side. Mm-hmm.
But when you say a reaction point, that's what bothers me. I mean, go ahead.
No, you could go, you know, it depends on how it's used, of course, anything. One of the things that would come straight to my mind is the whole women in refrigerators thing that came out, you know, a while ago, where women, you know, specifically rape. Let's be honest here. 99% of the time when there's a rape in a story, it's not a guy being raped. It's usually his sister, his daughter, his wife, his mother, and how that spurs him to become suddenly the, you know, vengeance or revenge or whatever, or the reverse side, the crusader, and they're going to rape his wife or his daughter or his mother to get back at him and teach him a lesson. Of course, after that incident happens, the woman conveniently typically disappears from the story, because what her important elements aren't important. It's how it affects the guy, which is, you know, that was that whole point where the women were, you know, hey, you're dead or you're murdered or you're raped or whatever. Rape being, of course, the only specific to women that tends to happen, and how it never really has much to do with the woman. It's all about how it reacts to the guy.
the real problem with rape, and this is the problem with rape in media, is that when rapes are there can be reasons for story elements of rape. I think it has to be very sparingly used, because it's very often used either, like you said, as women in refrigerator. Oh, my wife's been raped. That's why I'm going about this. Or it's almost used to take a female character down a notch. You know, it's like, and the recent outcry was the Laura Croft video, the most recent Laura Croft. Laura Croft has a near rape experience in it, and everyone's sort of thinking, so you're just trying to take Laura Croft down a notch. And the problem with all the rape things is they're always highly sexualized. You know, they're always, they're not just ugly, disgusting incidents. You know, when someone is murdered, we don't dwell on the murder unless you're watching, you know, some torture movie, you know, if you're watching Saw. I mean, I think rape in media is equivalent of murder in the Saw movies, where it is just highly fetishized. And there is just a lot of time spent on the sexual element of it. And that destroys your point. The moment you're doing that, then you're not actually portraying a story element. You're just there to justify a fetish.
I actually cannot disagree with that, because a lot of it, I mean, rape is probably one of, next to child molestation, which is basically the rape of a child, probably one of the most shocking and disgusting things that we have as a civilized society can have. I mean, murder takes place, murder happens, and in certain cultures, it's almost expected. But rape is something else, because A, it leaves, in most cases, the victim is left alive and has to continue through the torture that goes through that.
But now, I'm going to disagree with that. I think on a legal standpoint, that murder is worse. If I'm given a choice of someone raping me or someone killing me, I'm going to pick rape. You know, that's a very clear cut.
The thing about rape, though, keep in mind, is that rape is not just about the action that happens. It's not just about what has occurred. It's also about living through all of the social humiliation that is associated with rape. Yeah. Because once you've been raped, you're seen as a broken person. You are seen as somebody who is in fact not as valuable or not as complete as they were before. And there's nothing you can do that. Like, you can just look at, if you know, like, somebody who has, oftentimes women don't report rape because they don't want to be treated like a rape victim. There is a reason why it's a stereotype, is because that they do. And it's like murder, you're done. It's like when you're dead, you're not, you know, people aren't thinking badly of you because you got killed. And you know, you're not suffering through, you know, social torture for the next however long you live. And your ability to have intimacy with other people, your ability to relate to other people, your ability to make friends, your ability to get jobs, you know, like, everything in your life is suddenly affected by the fact that this event happened to you. So it's not just about the fact that you got raped. It's about the fact that all the social implications of
how many times, how many times have you heard somebody say, well, that person deserved to be killed because of what they were dressing or how they were dressing?
It does happen, but it's
not. You're wearing a soldier uniform. That's usually the justification. And they were wearing the uniform of the opposing army. They deserve to be killed.
Let me go ahead and interject here that normally we would go ahead and end the podcast about now. I want to continue on the discussion for this one for at least another 10 minutes or so, because this is something that is, at least to me, both rape and murder are very hackish. It's a shortcut for the drama in a story, and how this is being used. I mean, to me, that's the core, the core element of this story.
Well, there's two elements, you know, two elements that are interesting to me, just thinking about what you guys have talked about so far. Number one, I was reading something the other day that actually, as far as I believe, the estimates right now are the numbers of rapes for male versus female is what most people think about. It's actually a lot more male rape happens, and in fact is happening, in prison contexts, than it ever gets reported. And that has its own interesting thing, because it very rarely gets reported because, you know, the quote devastating element of being emasculated is for being male. While it's very devastating for women, certainly, I'm not trying to minimize that, but it's interesting because men report it even less.
For probably the same reasons.
Exactly.
Oh, it's worse.
Exactly.
And how many times in a movie, in a comic book, in anywhere have you seen a guy getting raped? How many times?
That was actually my second point. You know, talking about this where, you know, storylines can easily be just like, oh, we'll just throw a rape in, blah, 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 to get this guy pissed off or whatever. Imagine a situation. Now, we've all seen like various movies out there where, you know, the guy's wife or daughter gets threatened with rape or whatever, or even in fact happens on screen or in a book. Imagine if that many circumstances happened with a male character being raped and it was done in the way we all know, sexualized manner, where like, say it was a prison rape and like, you know, the one male is holding the other one and like gripping him and it actually tried to make it sexualized. Can you imagine how much of an outcry that would happen across all media? Like it would explode, but we practically accept it for the female side in every B flick out there. So it shows you definitely who would be more uncomfortable and who actually is being, quote, satisfied by those kind of story elements in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, I'm going to argue that if anyone given the choice, I mean, you say it is social torture. I still think that in the real world, if given a choice between being raped in prison or murdered in prison, I would pick raped.
Having worked with a lot of rape crisis centers on the technological side, there are a lot of women who were victimized by that who mm-hmm. would disagree with you. They would have much rather been killed or killed afterwards than have been raped itself. Because it is people want to go through, and even in MSA, after all the knowledge that we have about it, still want to make rape a sexual thing, and it's not. It is a victimization. It is a power that they have over you. They have taken something from you that you can never get back. I mean, if you're dead, if you're murdered, you're murdered. But rape is something that you have to live with every day after that.
And not just you, but your family, your friends. I don't want to be murdered. I mean,
well, look, yeah, we all want to live, certainly.
Yeah, and if you look at your standard action movie, if you're just saying that, looking at this, the standard action movie, the number of people who are murdered in your standard action movie for no good reason way outnumbers the number of people who are raped. And so the argument is, why are you complaining about rape when there's a, you know, 10,000 people being murdered for absolutely no reason? You know, the guard at the door of people is killed murdered, by your hero.
If we were to total up the number of people murdered in movies and on television in 1 year, it would depopulate the earth.
Yeah, but I mean, and the argument is the hero does the murdering. You know, it's always a villain, detestable person the rape.
It was a necessary killing.
Yeah, the hero murders people when they say, no, I can't let you in because I'm the guard, you know, and all right, I'll shoot you. I mean, so why do we argue that, you know, logically, no one wants to be killed and we are making killing much less offensive? Why are we complaining about rape in these contexts?
But let's also turn it turtle, because we know that there are people who do have a death wish, that they do wish to die. You have never heard of anyone having a rape wish.
Keep in mind, there's an old article called Rape Fantasies, which I forget which writer her name, but it was a joke on that notion of, you know, wanting to be raped. Like, you know, the whole like rape fantasy, like women have rape fantasies. Mm-hmm. Well, she was saying, like, you know, the thing in there was, well, it's not really rape fantasy. You can't fantasize about having something done to you that you don't want to have done to you. Like, that would almost be impossible. You know, like, how could you fantasize about, because if you're fantasizing, you want it to happen to you. It would almost be like being like split personality and have something done to you that you literally don't want to have done to you. But so, I mean, that is, you know.
Yeah. I mean, to get back to my point, murder is more common in media, but at the same time, murder is not used to titillate. It's, you're not, you know, you don't see the hero killing the guy and the blood splattering on him and he's smiling and having some sort of release from it. And this is what you see in rape scenes. And so it's the thing that's going on there is it's not a justified story element. It is purely a fetish element that's sort of being sneaked in.
Right. Well, I mean, we could say that about the murder too, because it's a different type of fetish. I mean, if Hollywood is using the rape scenes, but I'm specifying Hollywood more, but I mean, other media has it as well, but they're using that more as a sexual titillation, yeah, as you said.
But I mean,
there are the different types of titillation, and the murder one, the hero that goes through and shoots up and kills 1,000 bad guys with one clip. I mean, there are people out there who are maybe not orgasming over it, but they're certainly having a different type of release.
But it's. I mean, compare The Matrix, where lots of people get killed, to Saw, where a few people get killed, but it's very gruesome and very graphic. That's the difference between those two murders.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, actually, Saw is a good example, but actually the most extreme example is the Japanese series Guinea Pig, where there is no story as such, mm-hmm, and it's just, you know, 30, 45 minutes of somebody actually in, like, you know, blah, 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 theoretically chopping somebody up and torturing them. That would be the most, but the funny part about those videos is they do try to appeal to people who like the notion of watching that sort of stuff. You know,
those items are not mainstream. That's the difference. We don't accept those. We don't see that as mainstream. We don't even claim that they're valid story elements, but there is constantly a claim that rape is a valid story element. And I think it doesn't belong as such. I mean, very, very rarely does it belong as such. And if it is, it should dominate your entire story. That should be it. You know,
well, it shouldn't be a one-off, certainly.
Yeah.
You know,
well, the different Law and Order series they have over on NBC. I mean, you've got one that handles, which the standard series is normally about somebody's been killed and you've got to, mm-hmm, investigate it. But they do have another one which is all about sexual crimes. So, I mean, every week something happens.
Well, Criminal Minds actually deals a lot with, like, sexual sadism and various, like, and how killers can achieve it, and a sexualized, like, view of murder. Like, a lot of the stuff, is actually like the way that they present it is that they're motivated by sexual needs, like 90% of the time for the male killers, and that the female killers are not. And I mean, rape often goes hand in hand with these murders, but it's like a mainstream thing where they're, you know, somebody's killed and they go and they check it out and as to why they were killed. But they do, if you watched enough of it, is like a lot of it is sexually motivated. So it's interesting that way. I mean, it can be used. I've seen it used, like, at least I know there's a few shows out there where, like, a female character is raped and that actually starts her on a path to being a sadistic killer. Of the people who wronged her. But, you know, again, it's one of those things. But if somebody kills your daughter, you know, you're probably going to go on a rampage to revenge them too. So, you know, it's the same sort of plot device. It's just whether or not they lived or didn't live through it.
Because
oftentimes
note,
people are murdered and raped at the same time. So.
On that note, I'm going to go ahead and bring this conversation to an end. I do want to end it with one link, and that is www.unheardtaunts.com/WIR. That is the both famous and infamous Women in Refrigerators site, where it does bring in a lot of the viewpoints that we've talked about here. But I want to go ahead and thank everybody for joining us today, starting off with our guest today, Harknell and Onizumi. Again, you can see more about them and the Intervention Convention, which they run every year over in the Washington, D.C. area at interventioncon.com. Thank you, too, for joining us today.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having us. Definitely.
I also want to thank our news editor, Jason Strasberg, who's found a lot of the articles that we've talked about today.
I will pipe in for Jason. He had to take off. So,
okay.
He says thank you.
And playing the part of Jason Strasberg today is from BladeBunny.com, Eric Kimball.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And, of course, from Marie Terry, whose work you can find over at EvilSpaceTat.com.
Yeah. Hi. Bye.
And that leaves me, your host. I'm Thomas Revoir, from 910 Comics. That's 910cmx.com. Make sure to visit us and see our show notes over on the site. And we'll see you in the funny papers.